Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good day, everyone. I hope it's nice where you are. It's nice here.
It is nice here. Spring is springing.
Yes.
Finally.
Yeah.
So today we have a very serious topic.
Yes, we do.
But it's a very affirming topic.
Yes, it is. And it's important. It's important for everyone, because we just don't know what the future holds or what the future of our loved ones. And so this is a very important topic that we need to all consider.
Our guest today is Sunita Puri, and she is an assistant professor of clinical medicine at the University of Southern California and the medical director of palliative medicine at Keck Hospital and the Norris Comprehensive Cancer Center. She's also the recipient of a Rhodes Scholarship and a McDowell Fellowship and has published essays in the New York Times, Slate, and Journal of American Medicine, and she lives in Los Angeles. The title of the book is of her book is That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. And welcome to Writers' Voices, Sunita.
Thank you so much for having me.
So this book is really a kind of an introduction for a lot of people to the whole concept of palliative medicine. So maybe we can start with explaining what that is.
Certainly. So palliative medicine is a newer subspecialty in medical care that focuses on treating the physical, emotional, and spiritual suffering that comes when a patient and family are facing a serious illness. And a lot of people think that palliative care and hospice are the same thing. Mm-hmm. So just to be clear on the distinction, hospice is a type of palliative care that we provide to patients who are in the last 6 months of their life, but palliative care is available at any stage of one's illness, and it can be provided right alongside other treatments like chemotherapy for your cancer or dialysis for your kidney failure. So that's a very important distinction for people to know.
Whereas hospice is usually when other treatments have been withdrawn?
Yeah, so when we transition to hospice care, we're usually at a point where the burdens of treatment are much greater than the benefits of treatment. So, for example, if someone's cancer was very widespread and chemotherapy was just making them sicker and sicker, then that's the point at which we would say, instead of focusing on treating the disease by using chemo, we're going to use the services of hospice to make sure that your quality of life is the best we can give you until you pass.
Now, with palliative care, is it restricted to patients that have a terminal illness?
No. So palliative care is available at any point in any serious illness. So, you know, it's also available, I should note, for patients who don't have a cancer diagnosis, because I think a lot of folks think you need to have cancer to be on palliative care or hospice. So a very typical patient example I can give you is someone who, you know, may have had a few health problems and is now in the intensive care unit, you know, intubated on a breathing machine and on some intensive blood pressure medicines because they have a very, very bad pneumonia. And that person doesn't necessarily have a terminal illness, but they have a very serious illness, and we're not always sure what their outcome is going to be. So our team getting involved early when somebody is going through something that difficult helps us to get to know the family and sometimes the patient if they're cognizant, and to try to help them understand where they are at every stage of the illness process and to make decisions that feel to be the best for themselves.
And that's not easy.
It's certainly not easy. No.
You have some experience with this, don't you, Mom?
Yeah, I do. But, you know, the thing is, some people do not want to face the reality, and sometimes the family doesn't want to face the reality, and that's what makes it very difficult, I think.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in the book, I write about several particularly challenging families that I had to mm-hmm. take care of who, you know, may not have been willing to listen to just how sick their loved one was, no matter how many times myself and other physicians tried to explain it. And those situations are extremely tense for the medical team, the nursing staff, and for the family in different ways, but it's very disabling for us to feel like we are providing care that a family wants that is not necessarily what a patient would want for themselves. So these are very tough situations for everyone involved. But again, I think the earlier that the reality of someone's illness is explained to the family, the more time they have to process and come to terms emotionally with what it may mean to lose someone they love.
Yeah, that's the thing. If someone is on a breathing tube, it's difficult for them to communicate. Of course, mm-hmm. they can write how they feel, but sometimes they're also in the almost a coma state, and that makes it even more difficult. How do you handle that?
So, you know, when one of the examples I talk about in the book is of a young woman named Alice who was suffering from a very rare and advanced lymphoma and was on a breathing machine but wide awake. And those situations are actually very rare. Usually when someone's on a breathing machine, we need to sedate them so that they don't feel the discomfort of mm-hmm. the tube in their throat, which is extremely uncomfortable.
So they don't fight it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And Alice was wide awake. So I was actually able to capture her thoughts by having her write things out. But even writing things out, when you're in that a weakened state, it can be very difficult for people even to hold a pen, let alone form actual characters.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it's a real challenge, and I think sometimes people end up on breathing machines or on other advanced therapies in the ICU, and we know that situation is coming and have not discussed it. And those are the things I hope will change in the future, because I think we need to really reckon as a society with why we avoid talking about death and dying and even serious illness and suffering. Because the patients I see who, for example, might be suffering from terrible heart failure or end-stage kidney disease or certainly widespread cancers, and they end up on a breathing machine, I think it's a huge missed opportunity to have discussed with them whether they would want that, especially if their underlying medical problem may not be reversible.
Right. Well, that's a real challenge for for people, for the medical people to know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
My first husband, he had kidney failure and so forth, and he was, in the last, he finally had developed pneumonia and then passed away. And so it was difficult. It was.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and these situations are always difficult.
Oh, yeah. And I wanted to ask you, some people have told me that this has happened to them, that they're with their loved one for, seems like, hours and hours, and then they step away for a little bit, and that's when the person passes. Is that,
mm-hmm.
does that happen?
I think that people sometimes want to wait until their loved one is gone to spare them the pain of the final loss. I think it's analogous to when, for example, our pets who are dying want to walk away from us and hide because they don't necessarily want us to see them like that.
I
think I've certainly had that experience a number of times where people wait until their family members are gone and then they pass.
Because I had that experience with my husband too. I I was sitting by his bedside, and he was on oxygen, and I looked away, and there was nothing to look at. I looked at a blank wall, and at that moment is when he passed. And I couldn't understand why I had turned and looked away, you know?
So, Mom, you know, because you are in your 80s, although you
really?
Certainly seem much younger to me, but is this, you know, this idea of how you want to die, is it something you ever think about?
Yeah, it is. I'm so much more fortunate than so many of my peers in that I don't have any, you know, debilitating diseases, and at least I don't think I do. but you do have to think about it. And actually, it's good if you let your family know what you're.
Of course.
For instance, a friend of your dad's that was from Bloomfield. His wife had cancer, and she decided. I don't know how old she was, but she decided that she wasn't going to take any treatment. She said, "I've had a good life. I'm just going to let it go." So, you know, that happens too. There's all different possibilities.
I know we have such a tendency in our culture to think that you have to do everything. You don't want to give up. You don't want to just give up. And also, you don't know what the outcome will be if you do take a treatment. It's possible you could live for many years.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's sort of like I've had friends who have been in this situation too. And I ask myself, what would I want to do if I were to find out that I had a disease that was almost certainly going to kill me in a year if I did nothing? And if I did have treatment, I might live quite a bit longer, but I probably wouldn't. And I'd be miserable the whole time and not able, or would I, so would I do that, take the chance, or would I say, okay, let's have as much fun as possible in the time I have left and not spend it in hospitals?
Yeah, and some of the treatments, of course, are horrendous, because any time you do something to your body that's going to kill the bad part of things, like the tumors and so forth, it's also going to affect some of the good parts of your body. So you have to, there's a lot to think about.
And like you said, it's very good to let people know what your thoughts on this, let your family and loved ones know what your thoughts on it are before you're in the situation where you can't express it. And, you know, I'm thinking...
Yeah, you get in a breathing tube and so forth. And like that one patient was in a breathing tube and in a coma, and or they had sedated him, I think. And, you know, that happens probably a lot. So
right.
they're doing what they're trained to do.
Exactly. And, of course, you were also in a situation like this with your mother, where you had to make a decision. She wasn't able to express herself. But...
Well, she had already expressed herself, though. See, she had written a letter and said that she did not want extraordinary measures. She did not want a feeding tube. She did not want, you know.
How old do you think she was when she wrote that letter?
I don't know. That I don't know. It would have had to be a few years before, you know, because she had senile dementia.
Right.
So she was obviously not able to think clearly for several years. So,
when she wrote the letter, did she give it to you?
Yes, she did.
Okay, so she was very clear about that, and so when you were faced with the situation where she, you were going to have to put a feeding tube in.
Mm-hmm.
And so then
you know, she, her doctor said, well, then that, when I showed it to him, he said, well, then there's, you know, then we can't do that. I don't want to do that, because she didn't want that. And of course she died, oh gosh,
very quickly after you made the decision.
Very quickly after that. Yeah.
I think it was that night where, and mm-hmm. they had told you, I remember this, that they'd said, well, it could take her a week to die.
Mm-hmm.
But she passed immediately, and I always felt it was that as soon as she knew that you were okay, you know, even though her mind wasn't working very well, but
yeah,
spiritual or a subconscious level, that she was waiting for you to say, okay, you can go. And then she did.
Yeah. Well, that happens, I think, too, to people when they get, you know, when you give them permission to go or whatever, you know. Actually, I've heard of people actually saying to their loved ones, okay, it's okay to give up.
Yeah. And it isn't really giving up. I mean, I think we need to maybe rethink that being ready for what, I mean, if you believe that there's something else, then
yeah.
It just means you're taking
going
the next
there.
Step. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right. Walking through the door.
Walking through the door.
Yeah.
Knocking on heaven's door.
Right. Right.
Well, let's return to Sunita.
Okay, good.
Do you find that even though most people, when asked for themselves, would say they don't want to have those extreme measures taken, those same people, though, when asked about a family member, may say they do?
I think it's really hard to make generalizations. There's certainly some instances of that, but there's also many instances of people who might want an advanced therapy for themselves, but not want it for their parents. And truly, what the family wants is much less of concern to me than what the patient wants for themselves. So I'm looking to the family to be that patient's voice if the person cannot participate in discussions. And I'm also having to be really clear about recommending or guiding them through what the best and worst case scenario would be with the different paths that are open for discussion. And I think that is equally incumbent on us as physicians, is to guide people and to make clear recommendations about what may or may not actually be in their best interest. Because otherwise, to put to a family a menu of choices when they're not often in the medical field, I think it's really our job to help them understand the consequences and benefits of each possibility and to make a clear recommendation.
Do you find that that doctors who are not in your specialty have difficulty sometimes with that because the urge is to do everything possible, whether it's really going to make a difference in the long run or not?
That's definitely something I see, yes.
Yeah.
And you know, in some ways I have a lot of empathy for my colleagues because none of us were really taught this in our training. I think what we're taught is to telescope onto a list of medical problems and try to fix each one, and not always to look at the whole human being and ask ourselves, just because I can do this treatment, should I do that treatment? And the gap between what we can and should do can sometimes be a very big one, especially with our frail elders, who might not be able to walk, but who have an aggressive cancer, and the chemotherapy is theoretically a possibility, but if they can't walk and care for themselves, we would almost certainly devastate their quality of life. Mm-hmm. So is it the right thing to do?
And then, of course, there's the issue that you never really know for sure whether something might fix the issue. And you know, there's always the rare few who do come out better and can continue to live a good quality of life. So that must make it even more difficult.
We always have in the back of our minds the people who beat the odds, for sure. Mm-hmm. But if we're honest with ourselves, we have many more examples in very critically ill patients or patients with very aggressive cancers, we have many more examples of people who are not the exception to the rule. And part of what we need to help patients prepare for is all possible outcomes. As it stands, we only talk about the good outcomes. And I think that's dangerous, because if we can't achieve it, then we come to the family without having prepared them. Mm. and tell mm-hmm. them that may not be able to pull your loved one or you through. And I think that's horribly unfair.
Well, there was the one case you wrote in the book about the father who had told he would not live, and he did live for many more years, and so that's why he was so determined that his son would also beat whatever he had. And I'm sure that happens on occasion as well.
Absolutely. And I think our role then is to help people understand the differences between their situation and their loved one's situation, because mm-hmm. the two situations were not analogous. And I hear this all the time where somebody will come to me and say, you know, I have a friend who beat the odds and had, you know, stage 4 skin cancer and beat it. And their loved one may have stage 4 pancreatic cancer.
Oh.
And those two are extremely different. We actually do have therapies to cure metastatic melanoma, but we don't have therapies to cure metastatic pancreatic cancer. So I have to kind of gently help people understand the differences between the example they're giving me and the example at hand. And it's not to say that we can't still try what's reasonable, but it is to say that they must be prepared for the vastly more probable outcome.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Sunita Puri, and she's the author of That Good Night, Life and Medicine in the 11th Hour. Now, Sunita, the book is part mostly memoir in the sense that it's mostly about your life and experience, both how you became a doctor and your early training before you became interested in palliative medicine, and then, of course, your segue into that. But it's also, you know, gives a lot of sort of factual and educational information about health, the healthcare system, and the end of life issues that come up in the end of life. I'm curious about really why you decided to write this book.
So I was always a writer well before I became a doctor. I have written for years. And telling stories, thinking about stories, reading widely, these were all passions of mine. And I think when I became a doctor, I gravitated towards a field that is very language-based, and that was no accident. And I wrote the book because I think I've kind of been writing the book for many years in one form or another, and it was always my dream to write books. So I pursued this dream by making time to do it and feel that I got very lucky to end up with a great publisher. And I'm very, very proud of the work I've done here. I think it's it was a way for me to understand how I bridged where I came from and what I chose to do, and to really examine closely on the page how a doctor's personal life can influence her professional life. Because regardless of whether we doctors come out and say it, we absolutely do have the influence of our own lives in the profession or subspecialty that we pick. And I also very much wanted to honor at least some of the patients I'd had a chance to take care of over the years, because their examples, I think, are very, very powerful in the choices they made, the choices they didn't make, the difficulties they faced, and how we supported them through it all. My goal was really to put my readers in the position of my patients and to have them consider what they might want for themselves in those scenarios and what discussions they should maybe have now while they're still well enough to have those discussions with their loved ones.
Yes, that's very important, very important.
You know, one thing that was interesting to me was that as I was reading your book, the patient's stories really, really drew me in, and I wanted to know how each story would end, even though in most cases, most of your patient's stories end with the patient dying. But still, that process was so fascinating, the decisions that they made and how that impacted them that I wanted to know how it went, you know, what their story was. But is it hard for you knowing that most of your patients' stories will end in death?
I think it used to be much harder. Like when I first started my palliative care training, now it's been, I think, 5 years ago, it was very tough then. But I think I have come to a good place of being able to see their suffering, to know that I am going to lose many, but not all of them, and to know that though I can't change the outcome, I can still help them fight for every good day possible. And I think this work would not be sustainable if every death devastated me. I think I have to keep a certain amount of distance, but also remain as engaged as I can. And I think I also have to make sure that I'm taking care of myself, especially emotionally, when I'm not seeing patients so that I can come back to them. So I wouldn't say it's easy, but it has become, I have gotten a better sense of peace around it.
Now, Sunita, the book also has a very strong spiritual element, and this is, I think, largely because of the influence of your parents. Do you want to talk about that a little bit and how your parents have influenced you?
Sure. So my mother is a physician. She's an anesthesiologist, and my father is an engineer. And yet, though they are both scientists, they are also both very deeply spiritual. And they both came from childhoods of pretty terrible poverty in India. And at the time, you know, their mothers, who were also very, very spiritual, really instilled in them a reverence for the divine and this strong sense of faith that a force beyond them would take care of them. And so as they left their childhoods of poverty and were able to become professionals and immigrate to the United States, one of the things that they really wanted my brother and I to have a strong reverence for was the sense of spirituality, something beyond the physical material world that could give us comfort and guide us. And I think, you know, part of how I ended up in palliative care was because those lessons they taught me that everything changes and everything ends, including our lives. That was something that I had to come back to gain solace and perspective when I was in my medical training and I was trying to achieve the opposite, which was to keep patients alive for as long as possible and to think of the end of their lives as my failure. But what they had taught me was that everything is impermanent. And just because you give someone a treatment that studies show will work, at the end of the day, you really don't know what their destiny is. And it's the reason why, you know, I would treat, for example, two patients with a severe heart attack with the exact same modalities, and one might live and one might die. And I did the same thing for both of them. And so seeing that in my residency training really took me back to the lessons that my parents had taught me. So ironically, I needed to become a scientist to really start to have a deeper reverence for the spiritual.
And isn't it interesting that the lessons your parents taught you influenced your decision to go into palliative medicine, and yet they weren't really in favor of this for you?
Yep. Isn't that so human, right?
Yeah.
And I wanted to not spare the contradiction in the writing of the book, because it was honestly what happened. You know, my dad, I think, had always wanted me to be a cardiologist. And, you know, my mom said that, why would you do this when you know everyone's going to die? What is the role of a doctor there? And, you know, it was definitely a lot of moments of tension. But what ended up happening later in the book, and this idea of my mom coming around and saying, I could never do what you do, you are much stronger than I am, that was the kind of approval. I'd always chased my parents' approval, and, you know, to some extent I still do. And that was a moment where I really felt validated that in following my heart and taking a different path, I had kind of done in many ways what my parents had done in leaving their country and coming here, not knowing anyone, but feeling like it was the right thing for them. So I, you know, it was kind of my way of paying homage to everything they had taught me about being brave and courageous and following your gut instinct, and yet they disagreed with it. Just so funny and so parental,
it is.
Right?
It is. Sunita, why don't you read from that good night for us? I know we picked out a section that I think this is a good segue into.
Absolutely. So this excerpt is from the chapter called Extraordinary. And to give a little context, I was taking care of a patient named Mr. Smith who had widespread esophageal cancer and was very confused and delirious, had no next of kin who I could call and ask for assistance with decision making, and who had come in unable to breathe because of a very big blood clot in his lungs. And I had made the very hard decision to focus on his comfort instead of treating the blood clot, given that he was also at a very high risk of complications from blood thinners. I spent the next few hours checking on each of my patients, re-examining them if needed, adjusting medication doses, speaking with their family members. It was 2 a.m. when I retreated to my overnight call room. I had not been paged for 30 minutes, the longest stretch of respite that day. I lay down on the saggy call room bed and closed my eyes. I could still see the image of the computer screen in my head, the orders I had signed seemingly pinned to the lining of my eyelids. I thought of how difficult it had been to tell Ryan, my intern, that I'd decided not to give Mr. Smith heparin, a blood thinner, even though Dr. Doyle, my supervisor, had agreed with my decision. Disagreements between colleagues about serious decisions for patients could sting, as I had learned from my mother. I was 9 years old when she first began to tell me about the decisions she struggled to make at work, especially if her opinions were at odds with those of her colleagues in surgery. She would sit on our gray and black striped couch, and I would sit on the carpet, closing my eyes as she brushed the unruly frizz that was my hair at the time, smoothing it with coconut oil, weaving it into a braid. My head was tilted back from the cumulative force of brush strokes, my eyes fixed on the white puffs that lined our ceiling, reminding me of vanilla cake crumbs. While she brushed, she told me her schedule that day. Today I have 2 cases with 1 surgeon, then I have to help out in the clinic in the afternoon. Her usual honeyed voice, a mixture of English and Hindi, was replaced by a detached evenness, a tone I didn't yet know I would adopt years later, the doctorly tone. As I heard her talk about work, I wondered why her voice changed. She set the brush down and picked up the blue bottle of coconut oil from Asia Sweets and Spices, the only Indian grocery store within driving distance of our home. It was the only place at the time that carried staples we needed: coconut oil, saffron, giant cardamom that my mother kept in the freezer, bootleg videotapes of old Hindi movies and the newly released Ramayana, calling cards to India, Ayurvedic toothpaste, velvety red bindis that my mother wore to prayers and parties, and, behind a glass counter, a multicolored assortment of the Indian sweets my parents loved. My mother's hands, small and soft, massaged the drops of oil first into my scalp and quickly down to the last stretch of my hair, pausing at the end to massage her own hands with the traces of oil that remained. "This surgeon always wants to do very aggressive operations I don't think we should be doing. One of the cases is a guy who's 90. He has so many problems already with his heart and lungs, and now he broke his hip." I was still looking at our ceiling, wondering whether the big earthquake I kept hearing about at school would cause the flecks of white to flutter down in the closest thing to snowfall I'd probably ever see in Los Angeles. "I don't think it's right," my mother continued. his heart and lungs are badly failing and you want to do a surgery? I felt her hands moving rhythmically between the three sections of my hair, weaving them together, stopping, reinforcing what she had already braided, and continuing. I really don't think we should be doing this, but it is hard to argue with the surgeon. She tied a purple scrunchie to the base of my braid and stood up. Time to go, she said. It would be years before I understood the complexity of the relationship between anesthesiologists and surgeons, but even as a child, I could sense the normalcy of professional disagreements during my mother's work days. I wonder now why she began telling me these stories when she did, when I sat at her feet and she could only see my back, not my face. Maybe it wasn't me she was speaking to. Maybe it was just herself. Maybe there was something about the simplicity of braiding your child's hair, of trying to tame it, that enabled her to say out loud how tough it was to bring order to the chaos in which she worked. I now wish there was something I could do to slow the tumble of repetitive thoughts in my head. Was Mr. Smith actually dying? Could I know that for sure unless I tried treating what might be treatable? Yet why did the mere thought of trying that feel nauseating? Did I do a good enough job of translating my gut reaction, the combination of sickening nausea and the sinking of my stomach that arose when I thought of thinning his blood and placing him on a breathing machine, into a rigorous and intellectual care plan? Was I being doctorly rather than emotional? I was midway through a yawn when my pager let out a series of beeps from Mr. Smith's nurse. His breathing has changed, she said worriedly. Please come evaluate him. Dying has a certain cadence and tempo, a recognizable prelude to an infinite stillness. When I first entered his room, Mr. Smith looked like he was sleeping. His chest rose and fell intermittently, and then more slowly. His eyes remained closed when I shook his shoulder. His heart rate slowed. The tempo increased. A hot wave of panic moved through me. I hadn't expected him to die tonight. Had my inaction expedited his death? Could the blood thinner have helped him have a few more good days? I pulled up a chair to the side of his bed and sat down. There was nobody to call on his behalf. There was nothing to do but be there. Goosebumps lined his arms, and I covered him with warm blankets from the ICU one floor above him. I moistened his drying lips with artificial saliva. Remembering a note referencing his love of folk music, I used my phone to play bluegrass tunes, dispelling the heavy silence around us with banjo, guitar, and pensive lyrics. I reread his tattoo. Where there is light, there must be darkness. All the light and promise of modern medicine, inseparable from its dark potential for suffering. At 3 a.m. that night, I held the hand of a stranger. I watched his lungs expand and release air first in great heaves and then in diminished puffs, felt his pulse race and then suddenly slow, looked at his beard and tangled hair and wondered when he last took a shower, when anyone held his hand for this long, whether he would have wanted company or solitude. For a minute, our pulse rates were the same. When it became difficult for me to tell whose pulse I was feeling, I kept my hand on his wrist and placed my other hand against the juncture of my neck and head, noting that my carotid pulse matched his radial pulse, that in this way, for this stretch of time, the pulse of an exhausted resident and her dying patient matched precisely. And then his breathing pattern became irregular. His heart rate slowed again. The dark sky slowly gave way to the navy blue of early morning and the day's first blush. As the sky brightened, Mr. Smith's breathing slowed even more. At 6:37 a.m., he stopped breathing entirely. His body remained, but he had quietly and comfortably moved out, leaving behind his tattoo, his bruises, his clot, his cancer.
Thank you, Sunita. And that was from the chapter Extraordinary in That Good Night.
You must have taken really extensive notes as you went along to be able to remember those things. That's amazing to me. That's really, really is. So how many years of practice does this book cover?
So it covers from 2010 to 2015.
Okay. And when you're writing about patients, are they all like specific? I know you probably change names, but are they specific details to that patient, or do you sometimes combine details from multiple patients?
So I don't have any composite characters in the book. So every patient is distinct.
Okay.
And I basically changed, in his case, I actually changed very little other than his name. In other cases, I changed diagnoses sometimes or the nature of family relationships to protect the families and the patients as much as possible. But in his story, actually, the physical description of him is pretty true to how he looked.
Yeah, I wondered about that, if you have to get permission from patients to use their story, or if you can change enough details that you don't need to do that.
Yeah, so a lot of physician writers actually are able to use the stories without asking for permission, as long as we disguise the details.
Okay.
And for some, they feel comfortable just changing names, but I felt that there were other, in some stories I changed much more than names, but stayed very true to the dilemmas that person was experiencing.
Was that tricky for you to do that, to be able to figure out how to do that?
It was, to some extent. I think the hardest part is that I actually know all their real names, so sometimes I forget the pseudonyms I gave them, and that
yes.
gets tricky. I had to reread my book closely to make sure that I knew all the pseudonyms.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about when someone has requested a DNR, and, of course, you have to, when they do that, then you have to, say that okay, that's what they want. But if they don't have that in place, is there any time when it's used, resuscitation is used in your line of work?
So do I ever have patients who go through resuscitation?
Yeah.
So sometimes, depending on the clinical scenario, I think it's important, even if they don't have a DNR in place before they got that sick, I think it's important, again, to help families and patients understand just what an extreme measure CPR is. It's not what we see on TV. There was actually a study in one of our very prestigious medical journals, the New England Journal of Medicine, that looked at the percentage of success of resuscitation on TV shows versus in real life. On TV shows, I thought it was brilliant because people do get a lot of wrong information from
Absolutely.
These shows. Totally maddening to me because it comes up in conversations and I have to restrain myself from going on a tirade about how these shows portray medicine. But the percentage of success on TV shows was like 88%. In real life, it's closer to less than 5%.
You're kidding.
So,
wow.
Oh, no. Absolutely. For patients who are who I see, hands down. And the success of CPR is measured mostly by whether we can get a heartbeat back. It's not measured by how people do after discharge, if they get discharged.
Yeah.
So people have no idea about that. And it's, to me, it's a topic I feel passionate about because, just like we say to someone, we can't take you to surgery because you're too sick and you might die during surgery, we also have to be able to say CPR is a medical treatment. And when we don't think it's beneficial, we're not going to do it. And for the patients I see, for 99% of them, if we were to put them through that, we would break all their ribs. We would cause tremendous harm and suffering at the end of life. And why do that if the underlying problem that would lead to their heart stopping is not one we can change? CPR was invented for mostly healthy people who suffered a car accident or another traumatic event, like a sudden heart attack out of nowhere. But it wasn't created for people with, you know, dialysis dependence, terrible heart disease, who can't walk. That's someone who's not going to benefit from CPR, and we would only cause harm in doing it.
So if someone's in the hospital and they don't have a DNR, but they are so in such bad shape that resuscitating them is not really going to help them, the doctors do not have to do it? They can make a call?
No. We can talk with the families and explain why we wouldn't recommend or do it.
Okay.
But I think we're very scared to do that.
Yeah.
Because we think that that should be up to a family. And one thing I learned that I write about in the book is a mentor of mine told me, if there's a medical procedure, again, that we theoretically can do, we need to think about whether it will serve the patient. So just like an oncologist might say, you're too sick for chemotherapy, I can't give it to you, we can also say CPR is a medical procedure. We can't offer it if there's no evidence that it would help you. And we instead would make you really comfortable in the dying process. But we have to have that discussion to help people understand that this is not an arbitrary decision.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, by the way, as you were reading and you were talking about your mother doing your hair, and she put a scrunchie in your hair, and I don't know if you know this, but scrunchies are coming back.
That's wonderful.
I know.
The 80s are back.
The 80s
I love
are back.
Oh, gosh.
Sunita, when I was reading That Good Night, I was thinking about another book, another guest that we had on our show some years ago, which was Katie Butler, author of Knocking on Heaven's Door. And I'm thinking, oh, I wonder if she knows Katie. And then I get to your acknowledgments, and yes, you do. How did you get to know her?
So I actually was a resident in my medical training when one of my cardiology attendings introduced me to Katie. And that was such a blessing. And she is, you know, has over the years, we've written a piece together. I think she's just a fantastic human being. And she really guided me through the vagaries of publishing and writing a book. And I just, you know, I'm seeing her next week because I'll be up in San Francisco, and I can't say enough good things about her. She and her partner, Brian, are just incredible human beings. And she's a gorgeous writer.
Oh, yes. And, of course, she was writing about her parents' end of life and how difficult it actually was to get the doctors to agree to withdraw a treatment from her father, and which ended up prolonging his life in a way that he would not have wanted. And how her mother, having just gone through that, was able to make a decision not to accept surgery, heart surgery, and did die too soon, like Katie says. But nobody can time their death perfectly. She may have died too soon, but she died on her own terms.
Yep, and, exactly.
Yeah. And so do you feel like the medical community as a whole is getting a better understanding of this and more willingness to work with patients like you do instead of pushing extreme treatments on them?
I think things are changing as palliative care has become more a part of mainstream discussions, but I think there's still a long way to go. There's still a lot of colleagues who think of palliative care as giving up on their patients. They think the word hospice certainly implies giving up. And I think it's going to take time and exposure to more palliative care specialists and patients who are asking for palliative care in order to really change the culture in a meaningful way. And I personally think that we need to start very early on in the training of physicians so that even from the first year of medical school, as they're learning about treatments for different diseases, there should be a parallel track of discussing what are the limits of these treatments and how do you acknowledge if a treatment is causing more harm than suffering, and when do you initiate a discussion about that with families.
Do you think if medical school had provided that training to you and it was more integrated into all medical practice, that you might have chosen a different specialty because you wouldn't have seen the need for to specialize in this if it was more integrated throughout?
I think it's hard to know. I think I was meant to do this. I really do feel that in my gut. So I think no matter what I would have chosen, if I chose something else, I think I would have been the sort of doctor that would have had a very close eye on matters of language in medicine, symptom relief, and kind of trying to see the patient as a whole patient. So I don't know that I would have necessarily gone into something else. But, and I don't, it's hard to imagine how my journey might have been different if I was much more exposed to palliative care. My suspicion is that I would have been drawn to it and hooked earlier.
Right. So, Sunita, tell us a little bit about your writing process. Yes, did you write the book kind of from beginning to end? It has a fairly chronological structure to it. So,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it kind of makes sense. Or did you have another way of writing the pieces and then putting them together later?
So some of the pieces, the chapter I read from, Extraordinary, was actually published as an essay in the medical narrative section of the Journal of the American Medical Association. So there were pieces of the book I had written and refined before I started writing the whole book. But I mostly wrote it, I wrote it while working full-time as a physician, which I still don't understand.
That's
how
my other
in the
question.
World I did that. Who knows, man? That, people ask me that. I'm like, I have no effing idea how I wrote this when I was working full time. So I think what helped a lot was just being disciplined. I think I felt as though if I procrastinated and didn't stick to a schedule, that I would be a writer who had spent like 10 or 15 years on her first book, and I didn't want that for myself. So I spoke with my editor and I said, maybe you can help gently keep me on track by, every month I can try to get you a chapter or at least get you some sort of new writing. And that was actually very useful, as was the incredible opportunity to spend time at writing residencies. I was at McDowell, the Mesa Refuge, and UCross, and those were just serene, beautiful places that provided shelter and food and the company of other artists. And having those 2-week stretches away from the hospital, I would say I probably wrote about 30-35% of the book on those 2-week stretches.
Wow.
Because I knew once I go back, it's going to be very busy.
Yeah.
So I knew I had to kind of make the most of that time.
So it sounds like you had a book contract before you actually wrote the whole book?
Yes. I was very lucky that I got a contract before writing it. And that, I think, again, I feel incredibly lucky that that was how this process unfolded.
And was Katie a help in that, I'm guessing?
Well, she provided guidance for sure.
Okay.
Because the process, the publishing world is so different than the world of medicine that I needed her to guide me through that, which was very, very helpful.
So did you go find an agent first and then the agent got you the publishing contract, or did you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And was it hard to find an agent, to get an agent? Some authors say it's actually, that's the hard part, is getting a good agent.
I was lucky to find someone very well respected who had read my New York Times piece. I had written a piece in the Times, and that's actually when everything started, because I got an email from an editor saying she was interested in the bigger book I was writing, because it was in my byline that I was working on a book. So the way this all unfolded was extremely, I just feel very, very blessed, because I know this is not typical. So,
absolutely. Well, the product shows that it was, you know, that it, the end book, the book in the end proves that it was deserving, that you were deserving of this all along the way.
Thank you so much.
It was meant to be.
That's so kind of you.
Yeah. It's, it's an important book. It's touching. It's easy to read. And it holds your attention. And, you know, you're combining story with information, which I think is the best way to convey information.
So. I totally agree.
So are you going to do it again? Another book?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to think of what might come next. And there's a bunch of different things that are running through my mind. So it'll be interesting to see what I'm most drawn towards.
Well, yes, it'll be interesting for us to see, too. And I know that we're limited on time because you have to get back to being a doctor.
Yeah. And,
by the way, one thing I noticed is that your byline on the book does not say doctor. When it seems like most books written by doctors, it does, or it says MD or something. What? Why did you choose not to say that?
Because I was. On, you know, in the book, I'm wearing my writer's hat. And so I didn't want someone to see MD and expect a certain type of book or a prescriptive book, for example. So it was really, I made that decision because I wanted it to be Sunita the writer being seen rather than only Sunita the doctor.
Well, thank you for sharing this time with us today. And,
thank you for having me. It's been wonderful.
And I think your patients are very lucky to have you.
Oh, that's so kind of you to say. I'm lucky to have them.
Oh.
Even though they're going through very difficult things, I, believe me, I feel I'm taught something every day by them.
Wow.
And I think about them a lot.
So. Mom, do you have a closing quote for us today?
You know, we're all going to die. And this book is exploring the reality of what it can mean for all of us to live and die with dignity and purpose.
Thank you. And thank you, Sunita. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.